Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. What comes to mind when you think about hotels? The grand lobby, the bathroom fixtures, the lounge singers? From the small drab public houses of George Washington's days to New York's palatial Waldorf Astoria and today's ubiquitous motel chains, America has been in the hotel business for centuries. It has a rich social and political history. You might even say hotels helped create American democracy. This hour On Point, the hotel, an American icon. Joining me from Albuquerque, New Mexico, is Andrew Sandoval Strauss. He's assistant professor of history at the University of New Mexico and author of the new book, Hotel, an American History. So great to have you with us, Andrew. Thanks.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Your book is unique and so interesting, and I love the story of how you got started writing it. In grad school, sitting in the lobby of a hotel, tell us what happened.
Well, essentially, I was sitting in the lobby of the Palmer House Hotel in Chicago, waiting for a sort of a convention of historians to begin. And I was looking around and watching people come and go. And I thought, you know, the interesting thing about hotels is that you can show up in a city where nobody knows who you are, stay there for a day or two or three, and then simply disappear. And I thought, the possibilities for misbehavior are considerable. I thought that that was interesting, and I said to myself, well, maybe I should do something on hotels for my dissertation. And I thought, well, there must be a dozen good scholarly books on hotels. But when I went back to the library catalogs, I found very, very little on the subject. And so I thought, wow, now here is my dissertation topic.
And you had it. You know, I always thought hotels were a European creation. But you say that hotels are an American invention. Tell us, what was the first hotel built?
Sure. The first hotel, as we understand it today, was the Union Public Hotel in Washington, D.C. It was begun in 1793 and created by a fellow named Samuel Blodgett, who was the essentially the building director for the new city of Washington, D.C. And he realized that in this brand new city, there was almost nothing there. There was pretty much the White House, the Capitol, a small number of houses. But to really make it a city, they needed a grand public house. Mm-hmm. And so he essentially ran a lottery, sold tickets, and decided he was going to essentially raffle off the hotel using the proceeds from the lottery to build it. So it was this big public project started that early.
But you actually date the inspiration for the creation of these first hotels to George Washington and his first presidential tours of the new colonies just a few years earlier in 1789. What did he find when he went out to stay among his visits?
Well, basically what Washington decided at the very outset of his travels is that he would not accept any private hospitality. He had many, many people writing him letters saying, please come stay with us when you come through our city on your tour. And he decided that as president and as the first president, he had to be above that. He had to sort of be the president for all the people. So he decided he would only stay at public houses, that is to say, inns and taverns. But what he didn't, I suppose, know was just how bad they were. So if you read his diaries from the trip, he's constantly saying things like, last night's tavern was, quote, not a good house. This or that was indifferent. And on his southern tour, it was even worse. He grumbled constantly. He wrote, for example, the accommodations on the whole road we found extremely indifferent, the houses being small and badly provided either for man or horse. So he was not impressed with the hospitality he received on the trip.
In fact, they were downright dirty and uncomfortable. And you talk in your book about how, you know, guests were sharing beds swarming with insects. I mean, this was lousy.
Yeah, it was really sort of an understood thing that when a travel writer would come to the United States, they had to write sort of elaborately on just how bad the food was, just how uncomfortable the beds were, just how much they had been overcharged. And so everyone pretty much understood at this time that the state of hospitality in the United States was quite poor. And it's precisely, I think, that embarrassment that when George Washington comes through, you see all of these letters being written to editors, you see letters being written directly to him saying, we apologize for asking you to call it a place so indifferently furnished. Letter writers say they sort of berate their fellow citizens for not being able to put together enough silverware for a proper dinner for the president. So people are really quite embarrassed about this. And indeed, some of the same people that you see expressing this chagrin are some of the same folks who invest in the first hotel projects in the 1790s.
Mm. Right, these construction of these public accommodations in various cities around the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in their origins, hotels were never merely commercial. As you say in your book, they were bound up with a civic pride, if you will, even democracy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. For example, if you note that the first hotels of the 1790s were all built in capitals, one built in Washington, the rest built in cities that were at the time the state capitals, Boston, New York, Newport, Rhode Island, and Richmond, Virginia, such that they were unmistakably an effort to show good hospitality politically as well. As a new nation, as a sort of nation that everyone thought was going to fail, they wanted to accept trade legations, to welcome foreign dignitaries and diplomats and say, we're for real here. We're sort of an important democracy, and we can build impressive architecture as well. There was a fellow named Wansey, who was an American travel writer, who said that he noticed that American architecture suddenly improved shortly after the approval of the Constitution of 1789, because then suddenly we took architecture that much more seriously. We had to sort of show who we were, not just by our political arrangements, but by the actual built environment.
Hmm. And then by the end of the 18th century, hotels had really become quite important. And yet I was so interested to hear in your book about the great concern that there was in the culture at the time among Jeffersonian Republicans who thought that the luxury of these places, as you quote in your book, would tempt them to love luxury and corrupt their sensibilities. There was real concern, wasn't there?
Yeah, precisely. Essentially, the 1790s was a time of real political controversy over what sort of economic future the United States should have. Those allied primarily with Alexander Hamilton thought that the United States should be a commercial republic, one very much involved in trade, whereas those allied more with James Madison and Thomas Jefferson thought, no, really, Americans should remain virtuous farmers, right? They should have their own plots of land. They should be self-sufficient. And that way, they won't be tempted by constant trade with Europe to become corrupt and despotic, as Europeans were. So really, the people who built the first hotels were very much on that Hamiltonian side. They said, if you're going to have trade, that means moving goods from place to place. And to move goods from place to place, you have to move people from place to place, to supervise the goods, to load them, to unload them. So the hotel itself was kind of a major gesture in this debate over the economic future of the country. Mm.
The title of your book is Hotel in American History, but you write a lot about hospitality. And I wish you to speak a little bit about the history and the importance of hospitality.
Sure. Well, this goes back a very long way. If you think about ancient Greek texts, if you think about the Hebrew Bible, if you think about early Christian texts, there's this constant emphasis on the importance of hospitality. For example, the ancient Greeks, if you read the Iliad, the Odyssey, there are these constant scenes of welcoming, of hospitality, where somebody shows up, they bring them into the household, they wash their feet, they anoint them with oil. And this happens again and again. And indeed, it's an expression of how important welcoming strangers was to the ancient Greeks. They believed that Zeus himself would become angry with you. One of the aliases, if you will, of the god Zeus was Zeus Xenikos, that is to say, Zeus the stranger. And he would do bad things to you if you didn't show proper hospitality.
And even in the Hebrew Bible.
Exactly. The same attitude, if you think of a couple of major stories there, of Abraham entertaining angels. He didn't know they were angels, but he entertains angels unaware, thereby showing his virtue and sort of foreshadowing his role as the father of the three major Western religions. If you think of the lesser-known story of Lot, where he has accepted two guests into his home, again, they're angels. He doesn't know that. A crowd in the city of Sodom gathers around the house and says, send your guests out so that we can sexually molest them. And he says, no, because the value of hospitality is so high that he would literally rather send out his daughters, right? Which to us sounds insane. But at the time, the idea of when somebody is in your house, they're your guest, you must absolutely protect them.
Hmm.
If we then move to the early Christian texts, right? There's of course, the story of Joseph and Mary, that the nativity, right? Perfect
sure.
for the season.
Sure.
That, you know, Jesus is born in a manger because there is no room at the inn. If you think of the story of the Good Samaritan, right? He comes across this man who's been assaulted and beaten. He takes him to an inn and says to the innkeeper, look after this man and I will pay. And then if you think of the direct words of Jesus in the just the Gospels alone, there are four or five or six direct admonitions. You know, you must be hospitable to strangers. So it's a major cultural value.
So what makes a great hotel now? Is what makes a great hotel now the same as what made a great hotel years ago, centuries ago?
I'd like to be able to say yes, but not necessarily. I think we're coming back around to the kind of status hotels used to have. But what really marked American hotels beyond the impressive architecture, beyond the gilt mirrors and the beautiful carpets and paintings and whatnot, was the sheer publicness of them. The idea that hotels were open to all people, which at the time they meant all white people.
Right.
They were open to all. The public was welcome in, and it was enjoyable and fun to be in a hotel, even if you weren't a guest. The dining room was a place of glamour and interest. The lobbies were sort of kind of places. They were local crossroads where people would go and meet one another. For example, there's a famous essayist from the 1840s who says of the charm of hotels, he says, quote, tell a country lady in these times that when she comes to New York, she must eat and pass an evening in a room by herself, and she would rather stay at home. The going to the Astor House and dining with 200 well-dressed people and sitting in full dress in a splendid drawing room with plenty of company, that is the charm of going to the city.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about hotels in America. Andrew Sandoval Strauss is with me today. He is assistant professor of history at the University of New Mexico, and his new book is Hotel in American History. You can see a photo gallery of some of the hotels we're talking about at our website, onpointradio.org. So, Andrew, in your book, you talk about the important meetings and some of the political gatherings during the Civil War times that took place in hotels. I thought it was fascinating. Would you give us some examples?
Sure. Hotels generally had this hugely important symbolic role in that era, leading up to the Civil War, during the Civil War, and in the latter days of it. A couple of examples. One of the key events that leads to the Civil War is Bleeding Kansas. It's these sort of constant fights between pro-slavery and anti-slavery militias in the 1850s. And indeed, one of the signal events there was the sacking of the town of Lawrence by a pro-slavery militia. And they are very careful to chase everybody off. And the first thing they do is they set up a row of cannons and they cannonade the hotel to the ground as a way of saying, you're not going to be here permanently. This is not really a settlement. We have destroyed your place for welcoming outsiders. As we move closer to the Civil War, for example, the inaugurations of both Abraham Lincoln and Jefferson Davis as the presidents of the United States and of the Confederacy. The biggest newspapers of the time, Harper's Weekly and Frank Leslie's Illustrated Newspaper, when they did their stories on their inaugural speeches, in both cases they started with full-page images of Lincoln standing atop a hotel balcony, sort of between the fluted columns, surrounded by a crowd of people with their top hats sort of throwing them in the air, 2 weeks exactly the same iconography. So they wanted to express that, you know, this man, this important man, had become president and he was showing himself to the people. The obvious place to do that was at a hotel. Just a few months later, there was an attempt, there was a thing called the Peace Conference held at the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C., just not far from the White House.
Yeah.
And a number of delegates from the North and from the South got together in a last-ditch effort to try to stave off an actual armed conflict. And so they sort of gather at this hotel and say, can't we work things out? And ultimately, of course, they can't. Just two more incidents. Shortly after the beginning of the war itself, there's a hotel in Alexandria, Virginia, that is flying a Confederate flag. And this can be seen from the White House, literally. So a group of Union soldiers goes over there to take it down, because this seems like an insult right in the face of the United States. And this guy named Elmer E. Ellsworth, who was a colonel in the Union Army, goes to the roof, takes the flag down, and is carrying it down the stairs of the hotel when the hotel keeper, who is a notorious Confederate sympathizer, comes out and shoots him dead with a shotgun. This is a major symbolic moment. In fact, they take Ellsworth's body and they sort of it lies in state. He was a friend of President Lincoln. So he becomes this very early martyr to the Union cause. Then later on in the war, in 1864, things are going very poorly for the Confederacy, and they seize upon this idea of trying to disrupt the Northern war effort, the Northern economy. And the way they do this is that they send spies to try to set fire to 13 different hotels in New York on the same day. And the fires were quickly discovered and put out. But again, it's sort of another effort to create a symbolic act, you know, that the Confederacy can strike at the biggest city in the Union and try to burn down its hotels. And if you looked at the newspapers a couple of days later, there were these double-page lithographs of these are the hotels they tried to burn down. So throughout the era, it's a hugely important symbolic site.
So from the Civil War to the rise of railroad hotels, which was so interesting because it facilitated business dealings along trade routes in this country, right?
Right, exactly. Well, the thing about railroads is that, remember, in the early days of railroading, it was a relatively new technology. And so you had to have constant places where locomotives could be repaired. So about every 100 miles along the track, you had to have, you know, a depot and a set of shops where repairs could be done. Also, remember that there were no sleeping cars until the 1860s. There were no dining cars until about that time as well. So the passengers also needed to be let out to sort of, to eat and sleep. This meant that there was a perfect opportunity and a perfect motivation to build hotels about every 100 to 200 miles along every railroad track. So as a result, wherever the railroads went, as they spread across the nation, especially from east to west, you'd see literally a line of hotels following that right of way.
In your book, you talk about resort hotels, which sprang up along, sprang up in cities like San Diego, the Hotel Del Coronado, that created and really populated entire towns. And you also talked about the seedy side of hotels as well, the Fairmont, the Waldorf Astoria aside. There were lots of places that were, you know, one night stand kind of spots. How did these come about?
Well, essentially, and I should say that the kind of misbehavior that was constant in hotels happened in the seedy hotels, happened in the finest hotels also, because all hotels have a couple of basic characteristics in common. One is that somebody can come and expect to be given a room. There was actually a law, and this actually links back to the idea of hospitality. There was a law that said that anybody who comes to your hotel, if you have room and they have money, you have to give them a room unless they're a known criminal, a known prostitute, etc. So that anybody can walk into a hotel and get a room. That room is, of course, a private place. So whether people wanted to misbehave sexually without being observed by anybody else, a hotel is a perfect place for it, right? You leave, the room is completely, the beds are stripped and everything's cleaned within a few hours, so there's no evidence of what you've done. If you're a thief, right? I mean, imagine people traveling in an age before credit cards, before traveler's checks, they carried around an enormous amount of cash. Mm-hmm. Ladies had to carry around whatever jewelry they had.
Right.
So not only was there this great stuff that if you were a thief, you wanted to steal, they were also nice enough to bring their bags with them. So literally, you could pack their stuff into their bags, pick it up, and walk out, because in a hotel, a person walking out with a bag seems perfectly normal.
Andrew, let's go to the phones now and invite some of our listeners in. David is calling from Milford, Massachusetts. Hi, David.
Hello. What a great episode for the holidays. I'm a little embarrassed. There are no presidents in my story, no great men in my story. Mine is an anecdote about 25 years ago. I was studying, I was a graduate student at Yale, and I was incredibly, you know, like most graduate students, incredibly poor. And you could still occasionally get an amazing, like, weekend special. So there was this art historians conference in New York, and all my fellow art historians were there, and they were all staying at the Hilton or the Hyatt, and these gorgeous luxury hotels, new luxury hotels. And I wound up getting a special at the Plaza. And they all thought I was crazy. They thought I must be paying hundreds of thousands of dollars. I was paying $60 for a night.
Wow.
I had a barrel vaulted bathroom. And what I'll never forget, and I think I'll probably never enjoy again because it'll never happen to me again because I'm not a president or anything, but I had a button come off my winter coat. And so I picked up the phone and I said, is there like a possibility of getting like a needle and thread? And I literally hung up the phone, there was a knock on the door, and a woman came in and sat on my bed and sewed the button on.
Wow.
And it stayed with me forever. I just wanted, what
a great,
story. Thanks so much for taking me.
David, thank you. Thank you. Terrific. That kind of service, I guess, doesn't really exist anymore, does it, Andrew?
Well, in a way it does, in a way it doesn't. You asked earlier about the difference between what makes a great hotel today and what made a great hotel in the 19th century.
Yeah.
And I think today what hotels are especially focused on is an incredible level of service. There were a couple of hotels that recently began to claim that they deserved 6 stars, not just 5, because they had this extraordinary array of personal services. So I think at the very, very high end, you still see that. What sometimes is lost a little bit is the idea that a hotel should be a social place, right? Not just you go to your room and they bring you all kinds of lavish dishes and provide you with services and have, you know, flunkies everywhere. But sometimes people forget that the lobby, right, should be a place of excitement. I think that's coming back with boutique hotels and
yes.
a few establishments that seem to be saying, let's bring back the fascination, let's bring back the glamour, let's bring back that sort of older understanding that a hotel is a place to go and see and be seen.
Mm. David,
for example, just
I was just going to say, David mentioned, the last caller mentioned the Plaza Hotel in New York, which of course is one of the world's most opulent hotels, and now is becoming an apartment building. What do you make of that sort of move? Does it make you sad? Are we losing something along the way when we do that?
Well, I think there are some reasons to be concerned and some reasons not to be concerned. Let me start with the latter. People have been living in hotels since for about 200 years. If you sort of look at early accounts, people would be saying, interestingly, at this hotel, there are many people who are not transient guests, but long-term boarders. You know, this is
right.
quite unusual, especially to Europeans. So this is actually a pretty long tradition, simply because also in the early days of hotels, when they were an experimental kind of a business type, nobody was sure you could actually make money off of them. So the idea of having a steady source of income with a certain number of renters was very appealing to hotel keepers.
Mm.
So this has been going on for a long time, and to think that it is new is probably incorrect.
Right.
On the other hand, if the privateness of a hotel, if the sort of condominiumization ends up closing the bar, closing the dining room, and making it a private space, then that really is something lost, right? Because, again, part of the fun of the hotel historically is all of the other people that you come into contact with when you're there.
Mm. Terrific. Let's go back to the lines now. Lori, is calling from Westboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I was so intrigued with the subject of this session because I have very vivid memories of traveling from California to Montana to see my relatives in Montana as a child in the 1970s. And we would go, and there was this whole ritual of consulting the travel book every night and evaluating the restaurant and evaluating what facilities were available and that kind of thing. And the reason why I called was because this was a lot of fun, but when we would get to Montana, we would stay usually in something akin to a strip mall, a motel, whatever was the best and mm-hmm. had the closest ice machine. And we would go on a tour to the Glacier National Monument Waterton Lakes Peace Park,
which
is a park that straddles the border between Montana and Canada.
Yes.
And in Canada, they had the Prince of Wales Hotel. We had little strip mall storefront type of motels. And in Canada, they had the Prince of Wales Hotel, which we would go into and marvel like it was a palace or a castle. And we'd go, and we wouldn't be able to afford even to eat in the restaurant, but we would wander around the lobby. And my understanding at that time, they still even dressed for dinner and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was such, I was just amused by your conversation because I felt like I had a field trip to the two kinds of hotels that you're talking about, you know, the basic American little thing that has enabled us to travel so much.
Yeah.
And then this European style, sort of like a huge hunting lodge for the elite and wealthy. Mm. So I just thought it was amusing, and I've never stayed in the Waterton Lakes Prince of Wales Hotel. And my mother, who is now 80, who is from Montana, and I were just a couple of days ago talking about how, you know, we really have the money now to go and stay.
Maybe we should go back.
I think we're actually going to have a pilgrimage to the
Prince
terrific. Of Wales
Hotel. Ah, wonderful. Those are wonderful memories, Laurie. Thanks so much for the call.
Well, I hope that when the caller does decide to go and see some of the great lodges that she also considers those south of the border here in the United States, because in many of the national parks, there's, you know, the Ahwahnee, there's an enormous number of extraordinary hotels, precisely of the kind she's describing. It may have been that in that park, you had to go to Canada to see a grand hunting lodge style kind of rustic hotel, but there are literally about two dozen of these, all built in the early 20th century in Yosemite, in Yellowstone, in a lot of our national parks.
So which ones are your favorites, Andrew? Which of the historic hotels that are still standing today are really ones to see?
Let's see. Let's start with the El Tovar, right? Sort of right there beside the Grand Canyon. It's a beautiful, beautiful hotel. It has a massive dining room with these extraordinary views onto the canyon, and it really does maintain that sense of publicness I was talking about.
Yes.
People sort of go up and talk to each other in the lobby. The dining room is this beautifully elegant place where they'll serve you a terrific meal, and everyone's sort of looking at the same scenery. It becomes a very social occasion, so that's one wonderful place.
You mentioned these historic hotels, and before we go to the break, I want you to talk about the sort of lower-level hotels that our last caller mentions. What about the most Motel 6-style hotels? How did they crop up, and are they different? Obviously, they're a different kind of experience, but what do you have to say about them?
Sure. Well, basically, a motel is the word motel is short for motor hotel. And really, motels arose from the invention of the automobile. If you think of hotels, they were really invented at a time when people moved around together on a steamboat, on a train, on a canal boat. But the experience of travel was everyone got into the same means of transportation, went from probably the middle of one big city to the middle of another big city, and then disembarked and needed a hotel right there. Once you have the car, people begin to sort of take their own routes, right? You can sort of take one road, take another. And so hotels become motels and get a little bit more spaced out. Because in order to provide low-cost accommodations, if you build on land outside the center of the city, you can get a lot more land a lot less expensively. So previously, when people all arrived in the middle of the city, if you'd built an establishment outside the city limits, there'd have been no way for them to get there, and you would have gone out of business. But once people are driving into the city, and you can be the first sign saying, you know, inexpensive lodgings at the such-and-such inn vacancy, right? You can get that that automobile trade.
Right.
And so it's really the invention of the automobile that kicks off the age of the motel.
So in researching this book, Andrew, what was the most surprising or the most exceptional thing that you found about American hotels?
I mean, in a way, just what you had mentioned earlier, the idea that the United States invented the hotel. In so many other ways, American architecture is heavily based on European architecture, mostly English architecture, to some extent French, to some extent Spanish as well. But the idea that this major building type, right, sort of, and remember that hotels are everywhere in the world. They're, if you thought of 1,000 years ago, there were many different kinds of institutions, the funduk, the zenodokium. Each culture had its own distinctive kind of hospitality. But now the hotel has taken the world by storm. Really, the idea that this particular cultural form is distinctly American was very unexpected, and it wasn't really until I found lots of European travelers coming and saying things like, the American hotel is to an English hotel what an elephant is to a periwinkle, right? another traveler who says, in the United States, the hotel is literally an institution. The system initiated here some 40 years ago has revolutionized the hotel system throughout the world. So it's not some sort of a nationalist position to say that hotels are distinctly American. Europeans, for more than a century, have been coming over and saying, this is new, this is different, this is not how we do hospitality in Europe, and they really can't help but be impressed.
When the steeple bell says good night, sleep well, we'll thank the small hotel. Together, together.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about hotels in America from the late 18th century to the Civil Rights Movement. Andrew Sandoval Strauss joins me from Albuquerque, where he is an assistant professor of history at the University of New Mexico. And his new book is Hotel, an American History. I want to go right to the phones to our callers. First up is Tim, who is in Albany, New York. Hi, Tim.
Yes, hello.
Hi, welcome. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to comment, first and foremost, what a great subject for me to be listening to. I'm driving a truck down the road now, and I spent 12 years working in seasonal hotels, and you brought back some great memories of some of the unique individuals I worked with on the east and west coasts of Florida, as well as northern Maine, out in Arizona. The mixture of people that you get in hotels, both culturally, educationally, and every way, it was just so impressive.
Yeah.
The way celebrities come to hotels and act as if sometimes they're their own. I was telling someone a moment ago, Robert Blake came into the kitchen one time and asked how I'm preparing his dinner, and stand there next to me telling me, oh, what if you did this and what if you did that? And I was a private breakfast cook for Mary Rockefeller on a little country inn, Astaku Inn in Northeast Harbor, Maine, years ago. A woman used to sit at 18-seat dining room table overlooking the North Atlantic and have me make her the same breakfast every morning. I did it for 2 years, and she never knew my name.
Wow.
You know, just the population of people that came through
right.
Some of these smaller hotels was just so impressive.
Great stories, Tim. Thank you so much for your call. Andrew, that brings up an interesting point. You know, in your book, you talk about these different characters and the corridor that links the Waldorf Hotel in olden times to the Astoria, which became known as Peacock Alley. Describe what went on there.
Well, exactly. This was the most luxurious hotel in the United States. It was a really ne plus ultra of luxury. And so people would flock there simply to see and be seen. It was about a 300-foot-long corridor with mirrors and lined with marble, and so it was just a beautiful setting for politicians, for writers, for performers to sort of go and put on their finest and simply walk around as if they were peacocks, sort of showing themselves off in the mating season. Mm. And hotels generally, again, sort of take on that role for a lot of people because they are very much the center of town, the center of happenings, especially in smaller cities, right? In bigger cities, there might be an opera hall or a concert hall, but in smaller towns, if you wanted to figure out what was going on, you'd probably go to the hotel.
The hotel, yeah. Harry is calling now from Williamsburg, Virginia. Hi, Harry.
Hey, how you doing, both of you?
Hi, good. Hey. Welcome.
I used to be head of the AAA Hotel Rating Program.
What a job. So you got to see a lot of different kinds of hotels, huh?
I got to see everything from rustic mom and pops, and that's not a bad term, mom and pop. I don't mean that in a derogatory
way.
Yeah,
no, sure.
But all the way up, I've been doing recently some consulting work in Vegas. Somebody just mentioned the over-the-top Vegas.
Yeah.
I think that's a good description of Vegas.
Yeah. Andrew, what do you think of those new hotels in Vegas, these just mega palaces?
Well, they're hugely impressive, hugely expensive, and just to see architects and designers using their creativity in that way with those kinds of budgets is amazing. And actually, I have a soft spot for Vegas, interestingly, because indeed, they're on the forefront of making hotels into public spaces, right? It's all about not being in your room, right? I mean, if there's one place in America where you don't want to be in your hotel room, it's Vegas. The whole point is that you drop your stuff in your room, you go down, you gamble, you see a show, you misbehave, you do whatever you want. But the whole idea is that the heart and soul of a hotel is downstairs, not upstairs. It's not, you know, the meals being brought to you in your room. It's the amazing restaurants, you know, one after the other throughout the city. So,
although I have to say the opulence of the rooms themselves are extraordinary. You know, the marble bathrooms and, you know, just the quality of everything is really quite something.
Indeed. And for a long time now, Americans have taken a great deal of pride in that because that kind of luxury could be combined with publicness. For example, as early as the 1820s, newspaper writers called hotels palaces of the public. That is to say, they were as luxurious, as opulent, as extraordinary architecturally as European palaces, but without the despotism, without the anti-democratic attitudes, such that this was America's way of saying, we can be just as impressive as you are, and we are democratic about it. And indeed, European travelers often came to American hotels, and the sheer democraticness of the public space surprised them. They felt like people were always coming up to them, tapping them on the shoulder, and just talking to them. I mean, common people. Mm. How dare they, right? To a European, just to have, you know, some regular guy come up to you in a hotel and speak to you was quite unusual. For Americans, that was the way we like to do things.
Back to the phones now for another call from Art, who is in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Art. Welcome.
Hi, all. There's an old story that up at Saratoga, New York.
Yeah.
The owner, Hilton, chased out an American ambassador who happened to be a Jew and called him a bounder and beat him up.
Yes.
Brings up discrimination in hotels, generally speaking, Andrew.
Yeah, well, the incident he's talking about is probably the Seligman affair, which in 1877, a fellow named Seligman, who was one of the most important financiers in the United States, went back to a hotel that he and his family had gone to every year for 10 years. But in the meantime, that year, the owner had decided that he wasn't going to accept Jews anymore. And it became a sort of national cause célèbre because this very important guy, he was a favorite of the Grant administration, wealthy, prominent, but because of his religion, they said, you can't come in here. And indeed, that was an age in which whether or not you could go into a hotel became a major political issue.
Take us into the 20th century and tell us about E.M. Stadler, who was quite a visionary when it comes to hotels, the most influential hotelier of his time. He built hotels for the World's Fair, right? That's how he started?
Indeed, yeah. The first hotels he built were disposable. They were literally meant to be used for that one year that the or the one summer that the World's Fair was open, and then they were demolished.
And they were cheap and flimsy and
precisely
enormous.
And that gave Statler the idea of building regular hotels very, very inexpensively, with inexpensive plumbing, with all kinds of materials that brought down the cost. And his whole business philosophy could be summed up in his motto of a bed and a bath for a dollar and a half. He specifically did not want to be the Waldorf Astoria, because that was for the elite. That was just for people with lots and lots of money available to them. He wanted to build hotels for regular people. So he would do things like put the same kind of carpet on every floor of the hotel. It didn't look as beautiful, but he passed the savings along directly to the guest. He would build a few blocks away from the very center of town. And really, he changes the meaning of what a great hotel is in America by saying, it's fine to make it luxurious and opulent and wildly expensive, but how about the rest of the people? And he's really the one who changes the idea of what a leading hotel should be, so, from exclusionary to pretty inclusionary.
And so then he created the model then that I guess hoteliers like J. Willard Marriott and Conrad Hilton and Howard Johnson used to further sort of transform the industry.
Absolutely. I mean, all of these major hoteliers were continuing that American tradition of a more democratic attitude toward hotels, right? That anybody should be able to afford them. And so sometimes people will say, oh, the Motel 6s are so, you know, blah, they're so average, etc. Maybe they are, but, you know, they're affordable. And if you don't have a lot of money, you need somewhere that you can stay. If it's cold out, if it's rainy, if it's snowy, just to have a warm bed and a decent meal, that's the first and foremost thing. And these folks made it affordable for a lot more people.
Here's Nick, who's calling from Boston. Hi, Nick.
How's it going?
Hi, good. Welcome.
All right. So I just got back from Miami like 2 days ago. I was down there for Art Basel. And the hotels on Collins Ave are unbelievable. I was actually staying in a hostel like way uptown, but every night we would meet up at some of these sort of Art Deco lavish hotels where you enter in and it's like a palace. There's like drapes flowing and columns, and you go into the back and there's a swimming pool and a fountain, and some nights there was even like naked people jumping off the fountain into the water. It was like something.
Wow, Nick.
In Greece. It was unbelievable. And I had heard that all these hotels sort of sprouted up during Prohibition because Miami kind of decided not to participate in that.
Huh.
I don't know if you guys know anything about that. Or,
oh, good. Thanks. Andrew, what do you know?
Well, actually, hotels are very important in the entire settlement of South Florida because up to the late 19th century, very, very few people lived there. And it was actually Henry Flagler who builds these grand hotels in South Florida and thereby encourages people to move there. So indeed, there had been incredible grand hotels as early as the 1890s. I don't think it's actually connected with Prohibition, since that applied to Florida as well. But there's about a 110-year tradition of building these extraordinary mm-hmm. over-the-top, many of them in Spanish style, then mm-hmm. later in Art Deco style. So South Florida has been home to amazing hotels for more than a century.
Interesting. Becky on the phone now from Shelbourne, Vermont. Hi, Becky.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a great show. I'm going to the bookstore immediately after we're off. I have two hotel vignettes. The first is sort of the romance of the hotel. I can remember as a college student with my first serious boyfriend stopping on a summer trip at a seedy, creepy motel where the water ran out on the ground and the towels caught on fire because of the portable heater. And that, I think, was almost as romantic as a later trip to the Ritz-Carlton in Montreal with a much later relationship, who's now my husband. There's something just about having that little space be yours for the night. Mm. That you're only focused on yourself and the romance and being away. And the other one is, as a kid, I spent with my family a lot of time in Watchill, Rhode Island, which is a little old seaside resort town, and going to the Ocean House Hotel, which is one of those huge old wood frame hotels where people went generation after generation, had the same table in the dining room.
Yes.
You
yes.
always knew, you know, it was just such a wonderful escape, and sort of felt like you were back in the 20s yeah. or the turn of the last century or something like that.
Great memories, Becky. I thanks so much for your call. I appreciate it. Let's get some more from Jerry now, who's on the line from Toronto. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I was just trying to think as I'm driving along here and talking about motor inns and so forth, and I was struck by Andrew's sort of comment that this is, you know, how people find their way. And I was wondering if he had any insights into the whole idea that how hotels and motels were portrayed sort of in the movies and so forth. I'm struck back, I think, immediately to the movie Niagara and how the motel, you know, played such an integral part of where that movie was. And then, you know, even in movies like Twister as it came about, and, you know, one of the critical scenes where they're in this old motor inn kind of stuff. And I just didn't know if Andrew had a sense of, you know, how those
yeah.
hotels and motels became part of the popular literature. Like
great
that.
Question, how Hollywood has portrayed them. Andrew, what do you think?
Sure, this goes back to really the early days of the big studios. If you think of movies like Gold Diggers of 1935, Ninotchka, Grand Hotel, the sheer visual splendor of a hotel makes it a perfect place to shoot a movie. Plus, there's the fact that a hotel is a place where people come and go, and so you can more or less put any two people together who might not have met anywhere else in the world or in the country, and because they're both in a hotel, somehow it makes sense. So if you want to put the heiress and the jewel thief together, a hotel, perfect, right? That you don't have to explain it anymore. So if you think of Hitchcock films like North by Northwest, the opening scene of Rear Window, there's sort of this constant use of hotels to set up a situation that then can sort of flow forward in the story. So they're great cinematic spaces.
Another call now from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Tyrell is on the line. Hi.
How you doing, Jen?
Hi, good. Welcome.
Thanks for taking my call. I had a comment. It was a military brat coming up, but I lived in San Diego, California, and the base housing used to ride my bicycle up to the Hotel Del Coronado. When I was younger, to basically go to play in the playroom and play on the beach in the area. While I was up there, I learned that the Hotel Del Coronado was the basis for the Emerald City in The Wizard of Oz.
Huh?
The person who wrote The Wizard of Oz actually stayed in that hotel and was writing it there.
Ah, great fact. Andrew, do you remember that?
That's really interesting. I'd never thought about all those sort of conical pyramidal structures in Oz and in the Dell, but that makes perfect sense. yeah, that's entirely possible, especially since, again, it was not too far from Hollywood and people could have seen that and been impressed thereby.
I was reading your book and I was thinking about the hotels that we talked about, Hollywood and movie making, but books too. You know, you think of Eloise living in the Plaza Hotel in New York. They've been the backdrop for so much.
Yeah, indeed, for a very long time. If you think of, you know, more than a century ago, writers like Edith Wharton, William Dean Howells, Mark Twain would sort of poke fun at the bourgeoisie and the sort of pretensions of people going to these summer hotels and acting very important and whatnot. In the 20th century, Joan Didion has done some really interesting work, one called The Pink Hotel, where she talks about the particular combination of attentiveness and loneliness that is common in hotels. So they're really very much a part of our national life from the founding up to, you know, the climax of my book is the Civil Rights Movement.
Right.
And so there are these key moments in American history where hotels are very prominent.
So in our final moments here, what do you want people to know about the American hotel, if there's one thing?
I would say that hotels are symbols of hospitality, and hospitality is a sign of how you treat outsiders. So that if you look at the creation of the hotel in the United States, you have to think, this is really a nation that is saying, come in, we are open to you, we're not suspicious of strangers, we are a democratic nation where you can move around if you like. And really the story of the hotel is of an institution that began as a very restrictive, very limited kind of a place that was just for the wealthy, and it takes until the 1960s. But finally, hotels become truly egalitarian, truly public. Mm. So the story of the hotel making good on its promise is, I think, the story of America making good on its promise.
Quick answer. If you could go to one hotel, which one would it be?
You know, I kind of like the Cosmopolitan Hotel on West Broadway in New York City because it's been there since 1851. It's really old. It serves a mid-level clientele, and I just admire the fact that they've been serving the regular folks for more than a century and a half.
We'll have to try it. Andrew Sandoval Strauss, Hotel in American History is your book. I really loved it. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.